Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host, Erin Gambrill.
Hello.
Hi, Erin. It's been, as we were saying right before the show, it's been a while. Can you remind everyone out there who you are and what you do and where they might have heard you?
Yeah, it has been a while. So I am a public librarian. I'm specifically a children's librarian and have been for, I think, 15, almost 16 years now. And yeah, the other books that we've covered, I think, were The Egypt Game, Winesburg, Ohio. Oh, Wind in the Willows, I think we did. Mm. Yeah.
Yes, I remember that.
Good to be back.
Listeners may be confused when they see the title of this podcast that we are doing Jacqueline Suzanne's 1966 novel, Valley of the Dolls. And I wanted to kind of back up here and say, yes, I understand this is not a book that that everyone read in high school. Many of you may have read in high school, passing it around,
yeah,
hidden in another book or something like that. I had been putting out a call for books for the special members episode of Sophomore Lit. And this year I did Twilight with Beth Aron. And I had pitched Twilight to you and you said, no way. And you came back to me with Valley of the Dolls, and
yeah.
I'm curious to know why.
No way, because I just knew that Beth is infinitely more knowledgeable and has much more interesting things to say about Twilight than I could. But also, I was thinking about bestsellers that that maybe people or kids read in high school or college, or just things that maybe aren't considered literary, like critically wise, like, you know, they're not maybe held up to a certain acclaim for their content, but that somehow caught lightning in a bottle. And for this one specifically, Jacqueline Suzanne, like, this is, I think, up with like the Bible as being like the most published, highest published book of all time.
If it's not still, I know that at one time it was the best-selling work of fiction in American publishing, mm-hmm, which I find kind of startling.
Yeah.
To the extent that I was aware of it, I knew that the book existed, and I knew that the movie based on the book existed, that the movie, which was very popular, is something of a camp classic these days, mm-hmm, that is so trashy that it's high art, in some ways that this book is too. It was Patty Duke was in it,
mm-hmm,
Sharon Tate, mm-hmm, in, unfortunately, mm-hmm, her last role,
mm-hmm, Barbara Perkins
mm-hmm, as our main character,
mm-hmm.
So this book was published in 1966. Have you read this book before?
Yes. This was, I think, my fourth reread, which I will say, I don't reread books, like, other than really for your podcast. Like, I'm not a big rereader of books. So it was really interesting to think about. I was like, man, how many times have I read this book? It's been a lot. And I can't remember when I first read it. I want to say I was probably in late high school. And I had taken, as I'm sure I mentioned on other episodes, I took a 20th century novel class. And once I did that, it like really opened up the doors for me as to like what had been published for in like the 20th century. And Valley of the Dolls, I think, maybe had come up as being one of the most highly published books of all time, or best-selling books. And so I had been reading things like Grapes of Wrath and, you know, Aldous Huxley and George Orwell, and I was really tired of old white dudes. And so I think just on my own, I took it upon myself to read Valley of the Dolls. And I think I also read her other one, because she's only, I think maybe there's four books that she wrote, three or four. I remember reading Once Not Enough, I think was the other one that I kind of read in quick succession. And I loved it. I mean, I've always liked things from the 60s, but yeah, there was something really entertaining about this. But I do remember reading the book first, and then I sought out the movie and liked that.
I think this is fascinating to me because you are much younger than me, and mm-hmm. and this book predates me. But on the verge of my memory, I can remember seeing this book still for sale in the 1970s in many places. And this was a book that changed publishing in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It popularized the big trashy novel, mm-hmm. Which dominated in the 1970s and 80s and was like people like Judith Krantz or Jackie Collins or mm-hmm. Rosemary Rogers. They were a book that advertised their sensational shock value on the cover. They were mm-hmm. A lot of them had blurbs on them saying like the shocking novel that gripped America, the horrifying truth about whatever. And it was such a publishing phenomenon that even books that had higher literary pretensions, like people like Erica Jong or mm-hmm. Lisa Alther, their books got marketed as these big sexy yeah. novels, maybe to their advantage, maybe to their detriment. And you don't really see that anymore. You know, I think that somewhere along the line, people stopped getting shocked by this stuff. And maybe the shock value was not the...
I was just looking. The publisher is Grove Press, who also famously published Henry Miller and his ilk, which, you know, obviously he wrote in the 30s and 40s and maybe before that, but wasn't really widely published until this era, until Erica Jong, who wrote a book about him. But I wonder if that's part of it too. It's like Grove Press, like they just found this niche and then everyone, and then they did really well. And then everyone tried to be like Grove Press.
That's yeah. the publisher now, but in 1966, the publisher was this very strange little boutique-y publisher called Bernard Geis Associates. And Bernard Geis Associates was also famous for publishing Helen Gurley Brown's Sex and yes. the Single Woman. And it was distributed by Random House, but this gave Random House plausible deniability to say, well, we weren't responsible for this.
Oh, right, because it's a little boutique house. Yeah, that's funny. Actually, on the copy that I have, there's a blurb by Helen Gurley Brown, and she calls it maddeningly sexy. That's her quote.
Yeah, Helen Gurley Brown has a different idea of what's sexy. Than
right. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So Valley of the Dolls is the story mostly of Anne Wells, a New England girl, you know, I'm up here.
Oh,
in
yeah,
Boston.
Right up your alley.
I think she, didn't she go to Radcliffe?
Yes.
A university that doesn't exist anymore, that was completely subsumed into Harvard, but was the female Harvard of its day. Mm-hmm. Very much, you know, like this blue-blooded Bostonian coming. Not necessarily Bostonian, but she educated in Boston, but mm-hmm. she came from a small New England town and from middle-class stock, and was horrified by the idea of growing up in a small town. Horrified by the idea that all that was open to her was getting married and having kids. Mm-hmm. So she moves to New York and enters this world, this glamorous world of show business, mm-hmm. As an assistant to a showbiz lawyer at first. And Anne has these two close friends, or sometimes friends, sometimes enemies. she has her roommate Neely, who takes the stage name Neely O'Hara. Neely is a talented young singer, dancer, who will, in the course of the book, make her way by virtue of her actual talent. And she also makes friends with another showgirl named Jennifer North, who really has only going for her sex appeal. But we're told again and again and again through the book that her sex appeal is very prodigious.
Mm-hmm. Almost otherworldly.
And so this is a story about show business, mostly New York show business, not LA show business, in the years following the war. I mean, it starts right after the war.
Yep.
It starts in 1945 and mm-hmm. it goes through like 1966.
It comes right up to the publishing year. So I want to say it's hard for me to detach the book from the movie, because after seeing the movie, I do think it's probably one of the most perfectly cast movies I've ever seen, especially in terms of the three main characters. And almost every book I've seen since, it really highlights on that. Like I don't have, you know, access to a previous copy before the movie came out, but it uses those three stars on the cover. Reading this, I can't help but think of those three actresses. It's interesting. Like it's definitely a die, and it's written by Jacqueline Suzanne. So it's a woman writer. So there's an element of feminism to this, but boy, it goes through some weird, twists and turns as far as, you know, how you think of feminism and a woman's place in this world. It's trashy, but I think it's compelling. On this, like now my fourth reread of it, I did find the ending to be a little hurried in a way that I hadn't experienced yet. But before you get to kind of like the final act, I think the pacing is really great. I think you get an interesting sense of these women. And honestly, they only really touch each other's lives at the very tiniest moments. Like they very much live separately. And the time that they're roommates is like, I think maybe 6 months or something. It's really quick that it goes by.
Yeah, they come together at the beginning of the book and then they drift apart, and then mm-hmm. they come together whenever one of the characters has a bad breakup, mm-hmm. then they move back in for a little while, or whenever something goes awry in their life, their lives crisscross. It mm-hmm. is, you know, it is interesting you talk about this as a feminist work, because this is a depiction of women going through the first ugly stages of the sexual revolution, in which they're expected to be sexually active in a way that I don't think previous generations were expected to be, mm-hmm. at least, you know, whether or not they were, you know, owing, of course, to things like the birth control pills introduction.
And divorce law and credit card, you know, the ability to get your own property. Yeah, a lot of stuff goes into that.
Right. And I think that, so all these things together start to open up certain possibilities for women. But along with those possibilities come the baggage of expectations on them, mm-hmm. the idea that women should always be sexually available, that they should always be, you know, down to clown with whomever. And that while the characters in this book have professional careers, they're highly circumscribed in what is possible.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone except for Anne is still looking for the rich guy that they can marry so they can leave work behind, and I guess mm-hmm. get the mink being the
big, mink is a big deal. Yeah. But let's be clear, a mink coat is the equivalent of like a whatever kind of car like a 45-year-old white man at the time was looking to be his marker of success. Like, it's not, I don't think, you know, like on some level it's like, oh, these are surface level things and like whatever, but like, it's, these are very much just the female, like this is the world that they have to navigate. And so they have to make meanings of the things that have been given to them or that they've been able to grasp under this patriarchy. I'm living in a post Barbie movie world. So I'm making these references that are, you know, but yeah, that's what I think of the, when they talk about that mink, it's a symbol.
The one thing that I found kind of bewildering about this book was, I did not, as I read it through, I was thinking, I'm getting no sense whatsoever of the actual day-to-day of Broadway operations. I didn't feel like I was actually being ushered behind the scenes of Broadway production. I was thinking, and I thought as I was reading, like, oh, this writer doesn't know anything about this world. And boy, was I wrong. She was a showgirl, and she was in movies and television, and she lived a lot of this. And yes. I'm kind of shocked that she didn't get more into the details of what the actual sausage making is of because we have all these hints all the time of this big musical that's going to happen
and hit the sky and,
hit the sky and this musical is the sort of the locus of a lot of the plot for a lot of these characters. Mm-hmm. It's where Neely is going to get her first big break. It's where Jennifer is there on as a kind of a chorus girl, and it's also where they meet where Anne meets this fourth character, Helen. What's her last
Helen
name?
Lawson.
Helen Lawson, who is the character who's the old time singer actress who has had her success and now she's aging, and she is an absolute monster to everybody around her, except to Anne. But then it turns out that she only wanted to hang with Anne because she thought Anne might be able to get her an in with her then fiance's father.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing about Helen, is she is incredibly horny throughout this book. And this is one thing that bothers me a little bit about this is I think that the book does a good job of underscoring the absolute cruelty of a world in which women's value is entirely based around their sexual value to men.
Yeah. How screwable they are.
To the extent that I pity characters, I do have a lot of sympathy for Jennifer, who doesn't seem to have much going on upstairs, but who really, really wants to run with what she's got as far as she can. But then Helen is presented as this monstrous figure because she has the audacity, I guess, to be a middle-aged woman who wants to be sexually active. And I feel like, you know, Jacqueline Suzanne, he is not really writing Helen as a tragic character or a sympathetic character. I think she's writing her as this, like, laugh at her character.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really know what her crime is, other than
she aged. She committed the biggest crime. And Jennifer, alternatively, committed the biggest, I don't know, self-sacrifice. Like, she did not commit that crime, which I don't know if we want to reveal when we want to reveal how Jennifer's character exits this book. But that's what I think about Helen. And you see it obviously repeated with Neely at the end, or there's an aspect of she's kind of repeating that Helen Lawson thing. But yeah, the amount of like fat phobia and like, I guess ageism, but you know, really it's all about appearance. It's not just that they're aging, as we learn that Jennifer's character is actually much older than she has said. I think when we meet her, she is telling people that she's 19, but she's actually, I think, 26. And then, you know, at some point she is almost 40, but people, she's supposed to be like 25 at that point or something. I don't know. It's the math doesn't math, but you know, with that, like that, there's this like sin of aging that comes up. Actually, weirdly enough, right before I opened my laptop up to record, I got a text notification from this brand called Frownies, which is mentioned in this book. It's been around since like the early 1900s, where it's this like thick sticker that you put on your skin before you go to bed and you like use it to smooth out your wrinkles. And Jennifer wears it before bed in one scene. But it's 2023 and I'm still getting a text message about brownies. So yeah, these things are, you know, pretty timeless.
I feel like this is the thing about the book. On the one hand, it's trying to be progressive, but on the other hand, it doesn't just criticize some of the bad aspects of society. It perpetuates some Yes. of the bad aspects. I mean, there's this really ugly casual homophobia that goes to the book.
Oh yeah, yeah.
The characters are always using slurs mm-hmm. to talk about both male and female homosexuals. But the weird thing is, I get the feeling from reading this, this is supposed to be hip, and
yeah.
With it that Jacqueline Suzanne is acknowledging that, yes, there are homosexual people out there in the world, and they're, yes, they are in show business, you know, surprise, surprise. But they're still treated as aberrant.
Yeah, as like second class citizens. And even with so Neely, her first husband ends up being this guy named Mel, and she makes the break from Broadway out to Hollywood. And when she does that, you know, Mel kind of has a really hard time adjusting and kind of finding his role. And so they end up getting divorced, and she ends up with this, she cheats on him with this designer named Ted Casablanca and yeah, he's like, people think that he's, gay, and, she's like, no, he's not, you know, like whatever. And, they end up having two kids, and she like lets him sleep around because he sleeps around with men, and she doesn't consider that, you know, competition. So A, that's problematic, but B, later, she does find him cheating on her with a much younger woman. That really sets her off. And then he even says something about like, you know, well, he kind of basically implies that she turned him gay or turned him bisexual. And it's real. It's a real leap. It's really not great. Yeah, there's a lot in this book that is not super great, but is of its time, possibly. I don't know.
There's also some really weird, almost Dickensian plot twists and contrivances. Very early in the book, when Anne comes to New York and is working for this this lawyer, there's a traveling salesman named, what's his name? Alan Cooper, who seems to be a salesman, but then he reveals himself to actually be this super rich scion of this Italian billionaire family.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep thinking, like, what world is this in which this happens? You know, this
seems to be out of her.
Yes, he was testing her, and doesn't want to marry Alan, but she's told by her boss and by people around her, go ahead and get engaged. That's the way you can string him along, and then mm-hmm. eventually you can drop him down. Which seems like terrible advice.
Sure,
Alan gives her a 10-carat diamond ring, and then when she eventually does dump him, tells her to keep the ring.
Yep, which is $20,000, by the way.
Right, and then later in the book, her first love, Leon Burke, mm-hmm. Gets all butthurt when she doesn't want to go settle down in New England with him, and he runs off to England. And at that point, he gives her his apartment.
Oh yes, yeah. I never thought about that. But she's like gifted these things.
What world is this where people are just giving, people stuff.
She's so like beautiful. I mean, that's her biggest, like, that's the thing too, is that like, so we have three major assets that these women represent to me. Is Anne is the face. She's so beautiful and so immediately likable. Jennifer is the body, and they refer to her, I think, as the body, and Neely is the talent. And as long as they can hold on to those things, they're successful. And that, I mean, you'll, you know, we find out later with Jennifer that she's not able to hold on to the health of her body, and Neely's talent kind of, you know, waxes and wanes, but Anne just has this great face, and like, you assume she's kind of nice. I think she, I mean, you know, she comes across that way, but that's her biggest thing. And I think that's enough currency for her to get through this world.
Right. Well, Anne also is an ingenue. She's very naive. Mm-hmm. And a big part of the book at the beginning, this book has this, you know, Game of Thrones style narrative in which we follow one character and then we follow another character. But mostly we follow Anne at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book. And, mm-hmm. and this beginning is very long compared to the other sections.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it revolves around the fact that she is still a virgin mm-hmm. when she comes to New York, that she refuses to sleep with Alan even after becoming engaged. And it's a big deal that she eventually gives up her virginity to this guy,
Lion,
who mm-hmm. is this Englishman who's been working at the firm and who's just come back from the war. But now all he wants to do is become a writer, who strikes Anne as an extremely romantic sort. To me, he always seems like he wants to be a writer the way the world wants to be a writer.
Yeah, you know, every man who left World War II and had some kind of education wanted to be a writer. Yeah, he also like trauma dumps on her in the first like 24 hours of meeting. They have this conversation, and basically he just kind of has this like conversation with her that's like, I don't know who I am as a person after going through this war. And I think she takes that as like, oh, that's so insightful. Like, he's so deep. And you know,
he's her emo boyfriend.
Yeah.
Everyone has a problematic relationship in this book, but Lion is kind of presented as like, oh, maybe he's the one that she could actually be happy with.
Mm-hmm.
But then he does this whole like walking off in a huff when she won't go live in the small town and mm-hmm. become a housewife, and literally leaves the country,
mm-hmm.
Shows back up. And at the end of the book, he's butthurt once again because behind the scenes, Anne has financed his return to America and kind of manipulated things so that he would leave behind his writing, which wasn't really working out for him anyway, and maybe come back to the firm. And then he got all upset because this woman was giving him money,
mm-hmm.
and it was going to, you know, it was all around. Everyone was going to know that he owed money to a woman or whatever. And then, you know, Lion turns out to be just as rotten as anyone else.
Yeah. Book. Well, and also let the record show that George, so they become Bellamy, Bellows, and Burke. That's a rough firm name. But not only does Anne finance that, but I think George's wife also does. And there's like some scene very late in the book where Lion asks George, he's like, didn't you, you know, have you paid your wife back yet or whatever? And George smiles, no, I don't intend to. And Lion says, I've just written the final check to Anne. I'm in the clear now. Blah, blah, blah. Like, I love that George is like, who cares, man? Like, who cares where this money came from? So like, we get an example of someone who's, but Lion's seen as this person who has like principles and like whatever, but it doesn't really, I don't know. He's such an unlikable character. I hate Lion Burke so much.
This is the other thing about this book that I found kind of depressing for me, was I wanted to feel sympathy for the various characters, but none of them seem particularly well enough drawn to me. And the other thing about it is the action, the bad things that happen, you know, if Jacqueline Suzanne was a slightly different kind of author who could write to the reader's empathy, maybe this book would be more clearly a book about the constraints of being a woman, mm-hmm. or of the toll of what it is to be in show business. But to me, it felt like, you know, back when I was a kid, there was a book that was called Hollywood Babylon, which was in bookstores everywhere. And it was all just like, here's one Hollywood scandal after another, presented very salaciously, very unsympathetically.
Kenneth Anger? Yeah, I think that was.
And it was like, you know, all the stuff, you know, the Fatty Arbuckles, the Jane Mansfields, all these things that like are like, oh, look how bad, you know, Hollywood is. And I felt like this book was a lot of like car crash, sort of like you're supposed to look at it and be shocked. You know, it does deal with sexuality probably more frankly than a lot of books at the time did, but the way it does is a character will talk about how her lover performed oral sex on her, and Anne will be shocked, like, what do you mean? It's like, well, of course you went, and like, and it's just thrown out there like, reader, aren't you shocked too? Aren't you titillated? Are you not amused? And I feel like, you know, thank God somewhere along the line people stopped caring about that so much. You know, it's like today if you write a sex scene, it's supposed to be in service of either the plot, or if you want to write it for the reader's enjoyment, you actually write a sexy scene. This just seems like, you know, I don't know.
I mean, in that sense, I think it's very, to me, it's very Jackie Collins. Like, That's how I read her sex scenes, where it's like, oh my gosh, you guys are doing it in the garden out in front, like, you know, anyone could come by, like, it's that kind of stuff. Where the other, like, quote unquote, like, controversial aspect of this book, though, is in the title, though, like the dolls. Like, I think the addiction part is big too. Like, they're, to some extent, these characters are empty and unfulfilled, and they're filling it with, you know, fleeting things like youth and age, and then it becomes sex and then addiction and drugs and stuff.
Yeah, so the dolls of the title are prescription meds that are being abused. And as far as I can tell, dolls is just a term that Suzanne made up, because I've never seen it anywhere else. And when I looked around, I was trying to find out whether this was an actual phrase that people used.
I guess
used
not, and... but you know, I call them dolls. Like, I have a little canister that says dolls on it.
How funny.
So, but I guess I got it from this book. Yeah.
So in general, they're talking about people abusing,
like, downers and uppers. They say, you say, like, Seconal and
barbiturates and amphetamines. And it was funny, because I'm the kind of person who likes to, like, look these things up as I go along, and I was looking at it, because the ones that they name by name, they had Seconal, which would had been introduced in the 1930s. They also use a sleeping drug called Nimbutal. And if you look this up on Google, I can confirm, if you look this up, what you will get is a page full of suicide prevention links.
Well, yeah, they're probably not prescribed in the same way, but they could have been in the 60s.
In the 50s and 60s, you know, a lot of these psychoactive drugs were very blunt. They were basically soporific, hallucinogenic, hypnotic. They were easy to get, a prescription.
Didn't they call one Mommy's Little Helper or something? Or?
Right. That's the Rolling Stones song, Mommy's Little Helper.
Yeah.
I actually have a story that pertains to this, which was when I was very young, when I was like between the ages of 1 and 6, I lived in New York City while my father was getting his doctorate of divinity at Union Theological Seminary. We lived in Harlem at the just above Columbia University. And the couple below us in the apartment building. This is my parents will probably write me and tell me I got this all wrong. But this is the story as I remember them telling me it later, was the couple below us were a German couple of psychiatrists, young psychiatrists living there. And they did not like the fact that Robert, my older brother, and I ran around the apartment all the time. And one day they came up and they introduced themselves to my parents and they said, "By the way, we can prescribe Valium for your children you want to."
So
apparently at the time it was treated so cavalierly that you didn't even have to get an appointment.
Wow. They could just, wow. I mean, yeah, we've come a long way, but yeah, my mom used to rub whiskey on my gums apparently for toothaches and stuff, and was drinking beer the day she gave birth to me. So, I mean, I just think, yeah, but it's wild. I mean, think about, yeah, LSD and cocaine being in Coca-Cola, like pharmaceuticals. Yeah, we're a little shocked by it now because of how regulated it's thankfully become.
But then we have, you know, we have OxyContin and that stuff, and we have all these, we have the whole opioid nonsense we've had the last we haven't really progressed that far, so.
Yeah, but even within the confines of this book, they do, it's not like super easy for them to get, like, I mean, I guess they're women of privilege, so in some ways it is easier for them to get some of these dolls, but they, you know, there's parameters that they have to behave under. Like, they can't just flat out ask for them. They got to tell a doctor they've got a bad back. The doctor will most likely write them a prescription for 25 at the most. And, you know, and it's, so they have to jump through some hoops and play a little bit of a game to get them. So, you know, but,
You mentioned earlier Jennifer's sad story.
Yeah.
One of the things about Jennifer, because her story is so body focused, if the first time you go into one of her chapters, I noticed that the word breast kept getting used, like maybe, and I was reading this in a Kindle, and I looked it up. It was like repeated 49 times in this book. And whenever Jennifer is on, all the discussion is about breasts.
Her breasts,
and
yeah.
her breasts, and her mom talks to her about her breasts and what you do to keep them firm and pert.
She does exercises.
And of course, you know, you get to the end of the book and it turns out that she has breast cancer and has to get a radical mastectomy because that's all you had back in those days. And you start to think, oh, I guess Suzanne has been doing foreshadowing this whole time, but but it seemed a little much to me.
It's on the nose. Yeah, I do. So one of the things I find the most hilarious about this book is the men that she gets involved with talk directly to her breasts. Like, maybe more, I don't know that I've examined it this much, but as much, maybe more than they actually talk to Jennifer herself. And they refer, and that's one of the reasons why. So I can give it away. She decides to end her life by taking an overdose of her beloved dolls, in lieu of getting a mastectomy. She doesn't want to get a mastectomy. She thinks that it's her asset, and that's, it's going to cost her, you know, not just maybe her career, but she also, I think, in that same scene, finds out that she's unable to have children, which is another thing that, you know, affects her and her upcoming marriage. And she, her kind of fears are validated when her husband-to-be, who is this much older senator, comes in and, you know, says, "I'm so sorry you were in the hospital, and, you know, but you're going to be okay," and like blah, blah, blah. And he doesn't really know exactly what's going on. And then he starts to talk to her breasts, and I think that just seals it for her. And she's just like, well, I'm going to go out and I'm going to look as beautiful as possible. She says something about how she like does her makeup because no embalmer could make her look as good as she can. And you know, this is, I don't know, this is maybe a little woo woo for this, but, so Sharon Tate famously plays Jennifer North in the movie. And, have you seen the movie, John?
No, I have seen the trailer. I considered watching it for this podcast.
It's so, you should watch it. It's really good. Patty Duke is, I mean, they're all really good, but Patty Duke is just like amazing in her role. But Sharon Tate it plays Jennifer very well in that, yes, that Jennifer isn't like, you know, she's really not much more than her looks as far as this book is concerned, but she is very sweet and very kind and just like puts people at ease, even though she is so beautiful. And I get the sense that Sharon Tate was a little bit that way too. Her suicide scene in the movie is really beautiful and like intentional. And she does like make herself up to be, you know, beautiful. And she puts on this gorgeous nightgown and she like lays in the bed. And that's how you understand that she dies, is that she just kind of falls asleep, whatever. And we know what happens to Sharon Tate in our real world. And I kind of like that she has this really gorgeous death in this movie when she wasn't allowed to have a peaceful one in real life. So there's something very sweet to me about that movie, as morbid as that sounds, but that's yeah, the movie's really, really good. I don't know. To me, I like it.
This is a book that deals with suicide, and mm-hmm. I think it deals with it in the way that I remember suicide being dealt with when I was a kid, which was it was treated as a bad thing, but it was also treated like really fair game for a drama, for books. Mm. A lot of books featured people taking their lives, and a lot of movies did. I think today writers are a little more careful with it, yeah, as a device, because we understand better,
like the messaging that can give.
Yeah, the messaging is bad, and that the and that, you know, there are certain things you shouldn't actually just be doing to affect. You know, you shouldn't mm-hmm. be writing suicides to affect. You shouldn't be writing rape to affect. Right. And that was also very prevalent in my youth. And that's a weird thing about this book too, to me, is that you know, Jennifer is an interesting character to me because she's one of these characters who enters the story, and I had to like go back and reread the pages before and say, did I know who this was beforehand? Right. Because she just sort of shows up at one point. And when she shows up, it's also mentioned that she was married to a prince, mm-hmm. and she's getting it annulled because they never consummated, or she's claiming they never consummated or whatever. And again, with the prince, I'm like, did they mention this before? Mm-hmm. You know, she kind of breezes into this book. She's there for a while, and then she kind of like fades out of the book again. Mm-hmm. And it's a strange, it feels strange to me.
Yeah, she's kind of like a mythical, like, I think she's so ethereal, and I think that adds to it, where it's like, it's almost like, you know, when you have a dream and you don't know like the beginning, like necessarily the beginning scene of the dream, you know, the end, because you wake up but you know, like it's really, there's this like fog that surrounds her, and her own sense of self-awareness, I think, is never really fully realized because she's so the object. And so we don't really get her as a subject because that's not really her function. And it's so damaging. It would be so damaging to have that assigned to you. And so I think that's why she just pieces out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have to say that overall, as someone who did not know the plot of this book, mm-hmm. and just read it for the first time, it strikes me as strangely formless as a book.
Yeah.
I would expect a book like this to have some sort of a climax, mm-hmm. or some clear, okay, this is the point where Jacqueline Suzanne is going to make her big point about, right, whatever it is she wants to make her point about. But it doesn't really do that. It just kind of like follows these people, and it gets to the end. And at the end of the book, you know, poor Jennifer is gone, but Neely and Anne are still plotting ahead, still addicted to their various dolls, and mm-hmm. at the end, sharing the same guy. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels like it could go on now for another 20 years or something like that with these characters. I always remember that line from The Simpsons, where they're sitting around, they're trying to determine what the moral of the story was. They just went through, and Homer says, maybe it has no moral. Maybe it's just a bunch of stuff that happened.
Yeah. I'll be honest. This is there's an element to gossip in this, and just observations of their lives and where they've come from and where they're going and where they currently are. That's pretty feminist to me in that kind of way, where it's not really this formula. It doesn't really have this, Jacqueline Suzanne is not Lion Burke, and she's not shacking up in some cold English manner somewhere trying to write the greatest American novel or greatest British novel or whatever. She's observing, she finds her New York life very interesting, and the time that she lives in and the 20 years prior that she lived in pretty interesting. And I think she chose to kind of write about that. And I don't know. I think that's kind of why I like it too, because there's another book that I've always kind of feel are cousins to this, or a cousin to this, which is Peyton Place, which is another, it's very melodramatic in some ways, and that does have clear plot points, and but it also contains that observation or whatever, whereas this feels a little more atmospheric and more 60s in that kind of tone poem, I'm watching a psychedelic movie kind of way, without getting too weird about it.
Right. Well, I think the other thing to mention is that Suzanne herself was, rode the celebrity of this book really hard, mm-hmm. and she became a fixture on the talk show circuit, which was a big deal in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And apparently developed literary feuds with Gore Vidal and with Truman Capote, especially. There's a story.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah. did you see that? Where Truman Capote was on, I think, Dick Cavett or something like that, and badmouthed her. And the next night, Suzanne was on, and Cavett said, "Well, what do you think of Truman?" And she said, "He'll be proven to be one of the best presidents we ever had." She was apparently a great wit, and I get the feeling reading this book that she was probably something of a raconteur in her life, and that a lot of the parts of this book may have been things that she had actually seen happen to various people or happen to herself, and she probably got a kick out of telling these stories at parties, and she put them all together into this one big book.
Oh, you know, that's true. The scene where she sees, so Neely O'Hare, so yes, I think Jacqueline Suzanne is all of these characters and none of these characters. I think Anne is an idealized version of her, down to her beautiful brunette hair. I mean, if you look at photos of Jacqueline Suzanne, Anne Wells, that makes sense. But Neely O'Hara and Helen Lawson, personality wise, I definitely think Jacqueline Suzanne runs in those, specifically in the scene where Neely O'Hara has made it, but is also kind of getting rumored as being a problem on set. She's, out in Hollywood now, but she's back in New York for a short amount of time. She runs into Helen Lawson again. They're at some function. They end up in a bathroom. The movie version is amazing. Patty Duke kicking open a bathroom stall is really funny. And they're throwing insults back at each other. And of course, at first it's very highbrow lady, I'm smiling at you, but I'm also insulting you at the same time. And then it gets real jugular. And Helen Lawson says something to Neely O'Hara about her husband being gay. And then she says something about your two baby twin boys are probably gay too. And that's it for Neely. And so she starts to attack Helen. She pulls her wig off, which is so scandalous and so great. And then she throws it in the toilet and tries to flush it down. And it's one of the funniest scenes ever, both in the book and in the movie. It's so funny to me. And that absolutely had to happen at some kind of Broadway or Hollywood party. Of course it did. And so, yeah, I definitely think that some of this is just this like societal, or not even societal, but like kind of, yeah, high society or showbiz society, observational, you know. This is a vehicle for those kind of anecdotes, which I love. Neely O'Hara, her lines are so funny to me. There's a line very, very soon in the book. It's like just a few pages in where, and it's funny because when you read this book, and then you go back and visit it, you see how far Neely's character kind of comes. So she's like 8, 17, I think, at the beginning. And so she's the youngest of all three of them. And she lives under in the apartment under Anne at first. And so they're, you know, on friendly terms, but they're not quite friends yet. And she's invested in Anne's life because Anne's dating this guy who may or may not be a millionaire. He turns out he is, Alan Cooper. And Anne asks her, "Oh, what are you up to tonight, Neely?" And Neely says, "Well, I've got cookies, I've got milk, and I've got a copy of Gone with the Wind. It's an orgy." And I love that. And then later, she can't take enough pills to make herself fall asleep. So you see, like, her threshold for entertainment has vastly differed over the course of the book.
One of the things that kind of depressed me about this book, and you know, I'm grateful to have read it. I don't think I would be reading this again four times, but one of the things that I thought about when I was reading this book was that, you know, we start out with Anne escaping domestic life, which is sort of what is available to her in her town, and going off and trying to make it in the world. And the world corrupts her and corrupts the people around her. I feel like it's a very sad world in which there's no way for women to be happy in this world. But the problem I have is I don't get the feeling that Suzanne is that concerned with that. I don't feel like Suzanne is like, okay, now you, the reader, go off and reflect on this. It's more like Suzanne is again telling tales out of school, and haha, isn't this strange and salacious, and isn't the world of showbiz weird? You know, I in just 5 or 6 more years we would be into the second wave feminism, and things would be changing, and I kind of want to see what happens to Anne in like around 1974 or something like that.
I mean, yes, I think that she's showing that, yes, there's no way for women to be happy, but there's a lot of choices that these characters make that aren't necessarily the choice that the reader would make. And so I don't know that it's like she's saying that this is this truism that you have to go through. I think what her message, if she has a message from this book, it's that the cards are really stacked against you. And there's a really great passage, I think it's by Neely, when I don't know, I've marked the heck out of this book, but where she says something about, you know, she has that pool out in LA, and she says, you know, "Well, if I stay out here too long, I'll get too tan. So I can't do that, but I can't, you know, go inside because of whatever." And then she says, "You know, they want me at these parties to be social, but they want me home at a certain hour so I can be back on set, whatever." And it's, to me, again, living in a post-Barbie world, where, like, if you've seen the movie Barbie that came out the summer 2023, there's a really great speech by America Ferrera, who really just, they're capturing the catch-22 of what it is to be a woman. So yeah, there's no clear path to please everyone, I guess I should say, to be a woman. And so to my Pollyanna view of that is that then you just please yourself. Like, you know, again, there's a lot of fat phobia in this. There's a lot of like ageism, and like, unfortunately, maybe you can control things like weight and appearance, but you can't control how old you are or whether or not you have children. Like, that's, you know, that part of that's up in the air too. Or whether or not you find a person who you fall in love with, or who can give you a comfortable life or help you achieve a comfortable life. So you can only find happiness through things like friendship, female friendship, you know, cultivating your talents, you know, going for what you go for. So yeah, I don't know. but I don't know that I need a message from this book, I guess, is the other thing. It's an orgy. It's like, I've got my Gone with the Wind. I've got my cookies and I've got my Valley of the Dolls. It's an orgy.
Thanks again to my co-host, Aaron Gambrill. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. You can write the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com, or you can join the discussion on either the Facebook page or the Incomparable Membership Discord. If you've enjoyed this exploration of the bestsellers of yesterday, you can hear more of this nonsense in my members-only episodes, available when you become a supporter of the Incomparable Network. How are you? I was asking.
Yes, I'm good. I'm good. Okay. It has been a while. I can't remember what the last one was. Oh, it was the Egypt game, I think.
Yes, it was the Egypt game. And you know, I'm so little on Facebook these days. I feel bad because there's people on Facebook I would like to keep up with, but I find social media just so horrible right now.
No, I agree. My Facebook page is basically, I'm in multiple cat groups. So right. I get cat pictures, and then sometimes I get the Steve group.
Right.
That's it.
Right. Well, we just got a dog, and he might come walking around in the back here sometime. But because of that, Marina gets a ton of dog videos right now.
Sure.